Hey everyone, my name is Andrew. I learned in a past interview show my hands actually shows people that I can be trusted, so I'm going to show my hands on camera a bit more. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I've done over 1,000 interviews, learned so much from all these entrepreneurs, and my goal for these interviews is to have people learn from them, build great companies based on what they learn, and ideally come back here and do an interview yourself where you can tell me what you've built. Well, today I've got a guest who, he tried to get rich fast, and instead he lost a bunch of money. He's smiling as I talk about this. It's one of those things that's easier to smile about in retrospect, but at the time was painful. And he didn't get rich fast. Instead, he got to lose his money fast. Now he's running a company where he's trying to get rich, I assume, a lot slower. And I know that the speed is not as important anymore for him. And the company is growing, and I want to find out how it's growing. I want to know more about it. His name is Nikolai. I even have it phonetically on my screen. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm going to give you a few more times.
So okay, I'll do it again. Wait. Pyriankov. Pyriankov. Yeah,
that's right.
There. You know what? I'm leaving that in there. Let people see that I've screwed up that name. And Nikolai is the founder of Taylor and Hart. They sell custom diamond rings online. This interview, complete with my mistakes, is sponsored by the company that just did such beautiful design work for me. It's called Design Crowd. I can't wait to tell you about it. And the second one is a company that actually redid the way we think about our site. They'll help you hire a great developer. It's called TopTal. I'll tell you more about them later. Nikolai, welcome in.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
What's your revenue right now? How much money are you bringing in selling these rings?
We're doing about $2.5 million.
A year?
A year, yeah.
And so how many rings does that equal?
So since we've started, we've done close to 2,000 engagement rings.
How about annually?
Annually, about 800 to 900 rings for last year, but hopefully triple that this year.
Okay, and the company's been around for how long?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
Impressive. And I went on the site. The way you do it is you kind of, it's like a checkbox, collection of checkboxes to pick the ring that I want and the design that I want. Am I right?
Kind of. Some people go down the checkbox approach, but actually our main differentiation is that for those who want to start from zero and have something completely unique designed for them, that involves sketching, that involves 3D CAD work. And so that's what we call custom, or in the UK, bespoke. What you're referring to is customized. And there's been a few companies doing that for a few years, but essentially they're editing pre-made templates as opposed to giving you a dragon ring, a lobster ring, something really interesting and creative like that.
I see. Okay. And so you do both of those options, but what sets you apart is the fact that you'll create something from scratch for me and you'll have somebody there to help me do it.
Yeah. If you think of most jewelers, they'll go from off the shelf to a little bit customized. We start from customized and go into anything you want.
Okay. All right. And we'll get into why that's such a big thing, but I've definitely noticed that it's a huge thing now for guys to customize the rings for their women. There's a fear of that, right? You customize, you get it wrong. What happens? We're going to talk about all that because you've got solutions for it and that's why the business has grown. But I'm curious about this thing that you thought was going to get you rich. It wasn't just you, but you and your friend David. What are some of the things that you and David were experimenting with back in the early days? I think every entrepreneur can identify at least a little bit with this.
Sure, sure. Well, I think a little bit of context is useful there. I grew up in South Africa. South Africa was, at the time, it was just post-apartheid. It felt like it was ripe for opportunities. And there was this culture, and you would hear it with your parents and the way they talk, and you'd hear it with like their friends. And the whole, it was a lot of, where can we do something like a little hack here, a little hack there, an import-export of this to make a bit of money? So we were exposed to a lot of that kind of thinking because there was so much of it going on. So when we started researching these things online, when you kind of you start finding like somewhat dodgy options of doing this kind of import export thing, but with digital things. So we got exposed to affiliate marketing. We got exposed to Amway or Scamway, as some people.
Did you do Amway?
Yeah, we did it. We were Ameroids, as we now say.
And then what? Sorry, give me one more, and then I want to dive into one of them.
Sure. So we did. If you ever heard of the $1 million homepage where the guy sold 1 million pixels.
Yes.
And we did the same thing, but for travel sites that was to promote the FIFA World Cup, the soccer World Cup. And we went around door to door selling pixels to travel destinations.
Did that work?
No, of course not.
You know what? How many? You know how many sites tried to copy that $1 million homepage?
There were so many. There were so many. And then we tried after they all tried. So no, that was.
Did you make any sales when you were an Amway salesman?
We made sales in everything that we did. And there was a lot of lessons coming out of that perseverance. So none of those were like, oh, we're going to try. Oh, you're not getting rich quickly. Oh, okay, let's move on. Every one of those worked. They just didn't have the unit economics or the scalability for us to commit.
What's one thing you learned from Amway? I'm so fascinated by them.
So it's a bit like the McDonald's thing where their business model is not what it seems. So, you know, everyone knows the story that McDonald's business is real estate, not food. So for Amway, it wasn't about selling products. It was about educating people on how to become self-employed. And that was the business, right?
That was they pretend that, or not pretend, but ostensibly the business is you sell people toothpaste and other household items, and that's how you make money. But in addition, you also sell them on the opportunity to sell to their friends all this stuff. And you make a commission whenever they pay to get into the Amway business, and you make a commission whenever they sell toothpaste, et cetera. And you're saying, look, that second part where you make a commission is obviously the bigger part. I get that. Did you learn anything about sales from doing it?
Absolutely. Well, a few things. And just on that point that you just said, I think it's interesting to point out that their business model is actually about signing you up to conferences where they get you all excited and not at all linked to Amway. It's all about like this kind of join the community of people who are going to create passive incomes and so on. And they sell books and they sell conference tickets. And the thing about sales that we learned is your friends, this is Taylor and Hart started like this as well. Obviously, your people who were getting engaged around us were coming to us and asking us for engagement rings. And similarly with Amway, the first people we went to sell to was our friends because it was easy. But what I remember is distinctly feeling very uncomfortable about it. So that just made me feel that there's a values thing and an excitement thing about what you're selling, so that when you do go to your friends, you're giving them something that you know is really going to help them in their lives. Because everybody starts selling first to their friends and family. And I never want to be in a position again where I'm in a line of business where I feel uncomfortable even going to my closest people and signing them up. So that was like a very strong values check. What I want to be doing in the future needs to be closely linked to my values and my own passions and not just randomly something that I believe is going to get me rich, as you were saying.
There were a bunch of things. I want to touch a little bit on this options thing. I remember as a kid getting excited about options, right? For a few bucks, you get to control a lot more money worth of stocks, right? And if the stock goes up and you bought a call option, then boom, you make more money. If the stock goes down and you bought a put option, boom, you make more money. And it's fast money. You got excited about it. And what happened when you got into options?
So basically, my savings from the age of six, I put half into Amway and half into the options. And they all went within a couple of weeks. And then it was back to working.
Didn't you also ask your mom, your dad to give you money for this too?
So no, that was how I had savings from the age of six. It was basically my parents putting money aside for me.
And all that money you lost in both of these projects.
And then I went to them and I said, guys, can I have my savings now? You know, and they were like, yeah, but are you sure you know what you're going to do? And I think my dad knew that that money was gone, but it would teach me some good lessons. And yeah, I think he was right. So he let me do what I wanted to do with it. It wasn't that much that it was like my university fund or something. So yeah, the options was really interesting. I'd been playing around with learning how to trade and invest for a few years. And obviously everything that you learn is really linked to investing into shares. And then the minute you get exposed to, oh, you can get a 10x return for the same movement in the stock. So you believe that you have the fundamentals right on the equity. So why not get a 10x return? So in a, you know, it wasn't actually an option. It was a warrant, which is a very similar structure.
Except the warrant, I think, is issued by the company itself, right? That's the difference.
I think so. It's so many years behind me now. But yeah, basically.
Okay, I get it. So all these things didn't work out. You're in South Africa. You're probably the only person not getting in South Africa, not getting excited about diamonds. And you finally say, hey, you know what? Let's just pay attention to this thing that we're so good at in South Africa. Was it David who said we should start this?
No, actually, I'm not going to get into the whole long story of this, but I was actually the first person to get into diamonds because of a family connection who gave me a part-time job. And the job was very simple. It was work in a Chinese-run showroom for the Chinese tourists that were coming from China to visit South Africa. And what would they see? They'll see all the famous spots. And one of the things they wanted to do is buy a diamond as a souvenir. Of course, a very expensive souvenir. And my role was to give credibility to the institution by not being Chinese. In essence, as clearly and as funny as that is, the owner perceived that having a young person that was not local would be something that would be very helpful to the credibility of the establishment. So I worked part-time there, and I learned a lot about diamonds. And then I introduced David when I left for England, where I went to the University of Manchester. And from that little introduction, he went and learned a lot about the industry and grew a business to $5 million turnover a year. Was running it out of Hong Kong. I say a business, but he considered it being self-employed. And I think that was the part where he hadn't built something that he could step aside from and say, that's my business. It's running. It's got systems. It's got process. It's got people. Because it was very much like his own integrity was what people were buying into when they were buying from him. And he said to me, look, Nick, I really want to start a company. I'd been at the University of Manchester. I'd been meddling with a lot of, continued to meddle with a lot of e-commerce and affiliate things. And he thought I'd be a good partner to start this company with.
And so you guys partnered up and you heard about the lean startup methodology. You started reading the book and you said, you know what? Anything that goes online should start with a minimum viable product. And you're smiling. What was your minimum viable product for the online diamond business?
I think the minimum viable product difference between what we've done and what the Lean Startup was encouraging was that you'd go and test what the minimum viable product is, not come up with it in your head, which is what we did. So we decided that the minimum viable product was people would buy the diamonds online because we had access to that. And we made a website that sold diamonds. And
just loose diamonds?
Loose diamonds. You know,
what would I do if I bought one of these loose diamonds?
We thought you'd then go on to find a jeweler and have it set in your ring. It sounds so silly now when I say it because I know how complicated that is for a customer to do. But yeah, nonetheless, and we didn't plan on having a loose diamond site for a long time, but we thought we'd launch with that at least, not realizing that when you launch with something, it could be a year before you develop further elements to make the minimum viable product actually function in the way that you imagine.
Did you actually get a customer for this loose diamond business?
Yeah, we had three.
Three
real customers.
And so these people just wanted to buy one diamond, take it to their local store, and have some jeweler put it in a ring. Is that it?
No, they went on to say to us, hey, by the way, do you offer anything else? And we were like, yeah, sure. Just because we didn't have the rings and on the website, that didn't mean that we didn't know how to manufacture rings. We just hadn't created the e-commerce elements around it.
I see. And so they ended up buying full rings.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. So even the people who bought, but there was one guy, let me finish that previous thought. Even the people who bought a diamond actually wanted a ring, not a diamond. And that actually is it's the purpose of a minimum viable product to see, will people even buy diamonds? Who knows? Maybe there is a market for loose diamonds that you guys would have tapped into, or now you've learned that people actually want to buy rings and that's helpful. There was one guy though, who wanted to buy $100 million in diamonds from you though.
It wasn't just one guy. We found very quickly. So you know, when you create a brand and you create a website, you attract a certain type of persona, and you never know who you're going to attract until you see from the evidence. And what we realized at a loose diamond website was going to attract a lot of people who wanted loose diamonds who were not necessarily, they are the typical kind of person that you see in the movies who is walking in the shadows, opens up his jacket, and he's got diamonds in his pockets. And what we found, which is kind of the sad, one of the sad parts of the industry. In addition to the conflict diamonds part that we work really hard to avoid, is that diamonds are also a commodity in a way. And they are a good store of value. So for the less ethical industries in the world, diamonds are a really good way of people transferring their cash into value and then, you know, basically smuggling it across borders. And I want to talk about that because it's a real thing. And we started having people inquiring about this and sending us this guy that you're mentioning. He sent us photos of his cash, like literally mountains of it. And it was obviously like a very scary thing to happen, to be involved in that kind of business. So that's when we realized that this wasn't the place for us. We didn't want to attract these kind of customers.
So he wasn't scamming you. He was trying to get money across the border and save his cash in a way that's a little bit more smaller than a pile of cash.
I mean, that's my assumption. We never ended up serving any of those customers. But being in the industry, you obviously hear about things, the kind of darker parts of the industry that come up. And I thought it was really funny that he thought that he could convince us with sending us a photo of money. I don't know what world these people live in, but
was that man named Tim Sykes by any chance?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
So, all right. You're getting some direction from your customers. You know what you want to do now. You need to create, you need to buy a bunch of diamonds and you need to start creating rings, right? You told our producer, hey, look, I'll be honest with you guys. The Jews and the Indians are really who have all the diamonds. You really, and you guys, neither one of you is Jewish or Indian, right?
No.
No. You're from Belarus?
Bulgaria.
Bulgaria, excuse me, from Bulgaria.
And Belarus. Dave's from Australia.
Yeah, so.
So we're not mixed for this industry.
So was that an issue for getting diamonds?
It was an issue for being trusted to get anything on credit or, you know, any kind of, so what we had to do, we've got a situation where we don't know anyone, they don't know us. So obviously we also don't trust them. So, but we are requested to start purchasing our stock in cash across border transactions from India without knowing those companies. So initially it was a very stressful experience. We basically put everything on, it's a bit like going to the casino and putting everything on black. We hoped that the odds were better than a 50-50, but it was outlaying all the capital into some stock, getting that stock, delivering to the customers. But then when we'd come back the second time, it wasn't that supplier who had what we needed. So we'd have to do that whole process again with another supplier. Now we've purchased and had relationship with over 250 companies. And what I mentioned previously, I thought was a very good positive side of the fact that we're not Jewish or Indian was that people know us much better because we're not.
So, you stand out more in their lives.
We stand out, right. We stand out, which has helped now in, being able to pick up the phone and say, hey, it's Nick. Can we get some better terms? They're like, hey, Nick and Dave from London. Sure, we're happy to help you out. And that also actually helped us to negotiate better. We found that between the same, like, so when Indian people would negotiate with Indian people, they'd get lower discounts than when we would. I'm not sure exactly the dynamic behind that, but we have noticed it because we had some partners who were trying to negotiate on our behalf. And when we picked up the phone, we'd always get a better price.
You'd get a better price?
Yeah.
I thought you were saying that if you were the same nationality as the seller, that you'd get a better price. Why are you getting a better price?
So it's without going into too much detail about the diamond industry. So we know the Jewish people were involved in the diamond industry for a long time. But the reason why the Indians are involved is because several decades ago, the Indian government invested into creating the equivalent of a Silicon Valley for diamonds by creating the right economic conditions for the Indian people to basically import diamonds, polish them, and export them. So they all get subsidies and they get better interest when they borrow money to start diamond businesses. There's all these economic conditions. So for that reason, when an Indian person tries to buy from another Indian person, they're basically saying, hey, you shouldn't get a better discount anymore because you already have these subsidies and this and that. But when we'd phone up and we'd say, this is the only way we can buy, our business can't survive if we don't get a better price, they extend an arm and they've given us a discount. And it's also how hard you push. You got to always pretend like you don't need it, which sometimes you do, but you got to still be able to hustle in that way. So I guess that's a little bit of old school hustling, even though we're very much a technology e-commerce business. Never realized that before.
The first time that you bought a big amount of diamonds, you weren't even sure if you were going to get it. You were a little bit nervous about it. And you guys, what did you do to deal with the nerves?
I don't know if I said this earlier, but it was a really funny night. We basically drank. We drank a lot. To the point where we didn't expect to have to do anything that night. We went home and we fell asleep. And one of the guys called us at like 2 in the morning. We were in South Africa. He was in India. So the day had started for them already. And that was the first time we had to basically, you know, a little bit still half drunk, had to convince these guys that we were a legitimate company and we weren't just a bunch of, we were teenagers at the time, actually. A bunch of teenagers trying to buy diamonds from them without knowing what we were doing. And of course, money talks. So the fact that they'd received the payment did help as well. And they sent them through to us and we held our breath for a few days. And yeah, a few days later, we fulfilled our first orders.
All right. We're going to get into what you did with this business and the huge mistake that you made that I think a lot of people listening are going to make it. Even if they had made this mistake before, they're going to make it again. We're going to get to that in a moment. But first, I got to tell people about Design Crowd. Dude, I'm so freaking lit up about it that I'm not even supposed to talk about them yet. They scheduled ads for a few weeks in the future. But here's why I'm so excited about them. I've hated the way that Mixer G's cover art looks in iTunes for a long time. It's just like black and white. You can barely make out that it's Mixer G. And who the hell cares that it's Mixer G? Like, if you don't know Mixer G, you're not going to be tempted to click on and subscribe to my podcast. And the thing that kept me from redesigning it is I'm so intimidated by design. Anything related to design just doesn't compute for me. I could see the finished product and know it's great, but I felt like I can't even tell you how to make it great. I don't know what to do to explain what I'm even looking for. And so anytime design comes up, I say, you know what? Screw it. I'm not going to pay attention to it. I'm going to pay attention to what I know. I know things like research. I know things like math. I'm going to focus on stuff like that matter, that I'm good at, and just, you know, deal with crappy design because that's just the way I am. Right? You can't do everything. So you pick the stuff. I pick the stuff I'm good at and I focus on that and let the rest just fall apart or fall to the side, I should say, not fall apart. But we re-signed Design Crowd as a sponsor, and my wife was out of town this past weekend, and I said, you know what? There's nothing else I'm going to do on a Friday night. I've got to just stay at home with the kid who's sleeping. I'm not going to get a babysitter just so I can go out on my own. I'll just hang out. And as I was watching Shark Tank on my laptop, I said, let's try Design Crowd. I went to designcrowd.com/Mixer G because they're giving a $100 discount. I said, screw it. I'll take the $100 discount that they're giving my listeners. And I just filled out this one little form. They basically said, what do you like and what don't you like? And I had like four sentences. I said, who cares? I'll just fill out four sentences. And as I started writing those four sentences, I realized I have strong opinions. I took a couple of screenshots and I included it. I said, you know what? I really like how this NPR cover looks on iTunes. Copy this part of it. I really like how Gimlet does their logo in iTunes. Use that, like mimic that size logo and so on. And I actually had a brief and I hit submit and I thought, who cares? Like $250. $250 is what I would pay if I paid for a babysitter and went out for a drink with my friend. If I lose it, I lose it. Let's just see what comes back. And I forgot about it over the weekend. I just went and played with my kid and just enjoyed myself. And then on Monday, I'm going through my email with my assistant and I see Design Crowd sent me a bunch of designs and I click it with my assistant looking on screen share because I like her to look at my screen as I do email in case there are issues, she can jump on them. I got to tell you, Nikolai, the stuff I saw took my freaking breath away. I'm telling you, I know good design when I see it. I don't know how to get to it. These freaking people designed something so good. I was in awe. I was like giddy like a kid. I felt like, for me, you did this. This is beautiful. They made all these freaking designs, all these beautiful works of art that actually have my marketing desire in them. I'm talking too long here for this ad. They didn't pay for me to talk this much. I'm that excited about it. I immediately took like a screenshot and posted it on Facebook to go, look at what I've got. Look at what I've got. And the feedback on it was tremendous. People loved it. They liked the one that I liked, you know, with me punching the screen and the name of the podcast really clear, my logo clear, but smaller so it doesn't distract. But they also liked a few designs that I didn't consider, like a yellow one that really stands out, which I didn't realize was actually worth even investigating. And now I'm so freaking lit up about these guys. I don't know which one I'm going to pick. I'm so excited that I actually will get to look good in iTunes. And a world of design possibilities has been opened up to me just because of these guys, Design Crowd. And so I was supposed to talk about another sponsor. I quickly moved them on our spreadsheet up into some other date. And even though I don't know what I'm supposed to say about Design Crowd, I'm just telling you my experience with Design Crowd. It is that good. If you're out there and you're listening to me and you need anything designed, really, these guys will give you a bunch of designs to like your whatever you need. You just list what you're looking for, include some screenshots if you want, link to stuff that you like online, and let them figure out how to do it. I don't know how to make this stuff look good. I don't even know how to express it. I do know what I need. And they did it. Try them. And they're giving every Mixer G listener, they're already super freaking cheap. They shouldn't even have to do this. But they're giving us $100 off. And I did it. I took the $100. It was super easy. It's so worth it. Whatever you're looking for, website design, logo design, business card design. Do I have anyone in my audience with – do you have business cards, Nikolai?
Yeah, of course.
You do?
Of course.
I have business cards. They're sitting in the freaking drawer. I never have an opportunity to use them. Usually if someone wants my address, I just email to them. But if someone out there needs business cards, these guys will send you a bunch of different business card designs. Frankly, just any design that you want, go to them. They will create more options than you thought you that could be out there, and they're going to take your design to a whole new level, because you got on Design Crowd lots of different, I got dozens of different designers, each one of them coming up with multiple options, at least from what I could see here, coming up with ideas that no single designer ever could, because they're coming at it from different perspectives, from different parts of the world, from different experience levels. All right. Design Crowd, thank you so much for doing this. Everyone out there who needs a design should go check out designcrowd.com/mixergy. It is such a good experience. 100% of your money back if you're not happy with it. You set the budget. You get all these designs from them. I'm obviously like shot out of a cannon about them. I really think you guys should all check them out. designcrowd.com/mixergy. All right. Now we got an understanding. Coming back to your story, Nick, I gotta like take it down a notch from the Design Crowd ad.
We're luxury, right? You gotta kind of pace
right,
it.
Right, I gotta go softer. But you know, sometimes I get really lit up about stuff, and it's fun to talk about it. It's fun that I'm in an industry where I still get excited about things. My dad was in the clothing business, and I could never get excited about it. Even when I used to work for him on weekends and after school, I would sell stuff and it was like, who cares? People would come in and get all excited about a shirt, and I couldn't even work up enthusiasm to sell to them. All I could do is be like an order taker on the floor. And I always said to myself, I don't want to be in a business where I'm not excited about what I'm doing. That's not the life for me. And everything about this industry I like figuring out how to post stuff online I like figuring out like the new technology that has nothing or not directly to do with the interviews, like this wireless earphones. The AirPods, I've been excited about that. And I'm excited about Design Crowd and the sponsors. Anyway, I'm also excited about your business, because I never would have thought that you could sell rings online. I bought a diamond ring for my wife when we got engaged. I thought you have to touch it. I thought you have to feel it. And you came up with a few solutions for that need. But let's continue with this story. You decided, I'm going to put it up on a website. You start building the website and you go with your intuition. What did your gut tell you about this business?
Well, initially, you know, we're just replicating what other people had done. And my gut told me that was going to make us like always catching up, because these guys were ahead. So trying to play their game with less resources, with less people, being in the UK as opposed to the US, which is the biggest market, we were never going to win. And we didn't actually come up with the idea that changed our business on our own. Like anything, we took it out to the market and that idea came back through one of our customers. So what happened to us is that one of our customers came by and said, listen, Nick, can I have an engagement ring? And I said, sure, choose a diamond, choose a ring, let's do it. And he said, no, I don't want anything you've already got. I've got an idea in my head. And he brought out these papers and these sheets and he started showing us crazy ideas. His ring never ended up looking the way that he imagined. He wanted the Eiffel Tower sticking out. He wanted a DJ booth because they met at a club. He was an inventor, and he read a lot about like 3D printing. So we started working on this design for him just as like a creative project. Very quickly we couldn't make any money off it because we invested so much time. And it took us a year
to make his one ring.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because every single stage was like, right, we just learned where to find CAD designers at the time it was on Elance. Cool. All right. Oh, but the first 15 CAD designers don't want to work with us or can't understand the brief. So it was about finding a good CAD designer. Okay. Right. We've got the CAD. Right, where do you 3D print these days? Oh, there's a bunch of 3D printers, but none of them 3D print jewelry. Go through 25 places until you find the right 3D printer. And then each stage was basically like that. And so it got to the point where initially he had told us he's not in a rush. And then it was 1 month to go. And he's like, Nick, it's been a year, man. Need my ring.
And you guys were able to get it to him in time.
We got it in time. It was our first custom design. His name was Piers, and his lady, Jenny, she was a botanist, or she was studying a PhD in botany or something of that sort. And he was going to propose in the Amazon jungle, and he wanted the ring to connect all three of those, kind of the mood. And so it was organic vines running down the side with diamonds in place of the flowers and the leaves. And yeah, he proposed in the Amazon jungle in a canoe on one foot. And he came back, and that's when we first realized we were onto something, because we started hearing other people tell his story and how exciting and how awesome it was that he designed her ring. He always used to say he'd get brownie points from the girlfriend's friends and a lot of hate from the guys, because he'd set the standard and they'd all go, oh, I want a custom ring when I get engaged, which I thought was really funny.
What is the thing with custom rings? It's becoming a thing. It wasn't in the past.
Yeah, well, you said something earlier, and I didn't want to interrupt you, but the main thing is because it's no longer just guys designing the ring. It's actually, that's one of the biggest like things that we didn't know that we learned. And we learned it. We did Techstars in Boston, and as with any accelerator, one of the things that they do is to challenge your assumptions. And one of those assumptions was guys are proposing to girls with as a surprise, you know, the classical proposal that we all know from the movies. And the reality is that that's not happening. And we've learned since then why that's not happening. The first thing is that millennials are getting engaged. Millennials are different, first of all. They're much more collaborative. They're much more emotionally intelligent about each other's feelings. But they're also getting married later. So initially, when we saw this trend of marriage rates declining, we thought that's because millennials aren't getting married. That's not true. What we've actually seen is that they just delay it a little bit later. By the time they're making this purchase, they're spending more and they're collaborating because they've been together for 8 years, you know? They also know each other better, which helps with a custom design. So, you know, or, you know, I'm confident she's going to like this because I know her style so well. So we sent out a survey. We asked our customers and we found that only 25% are guys like you. You said the complete surprise. She had no idea. Most of our customers either collaborate by doing the engagement ring together. Some have a large number have subtle hints, you know, sometimes not so subtle. And then there's a small part, about 15 to 20%, where it's women designing her own ring completely and saying to her boyfriend, listen, when you decide to get for us to get engaged, this is the ring I want.
Wow, okay. So, yeah. I get that. Yeah. Well, frankly, I would have loved that. I didn't even know that that was an option, that you can actually say to your wife, you tell me what you'd like. So yeah. Before you did that, before you surveyed your audience, what did you think you were going to create?
We thought we were going to create another off-the-shelf company that sells engagement rings that are pre-made. It was a difficult time because it was not inspiring us. All we knew for sure is that this company that there was there was a demand for this because only 10% of the market is buying online and that's growing really quick. And the reason why that's happened is because, as you can imagine, people first started buying lower priced items online before they trusted the internet to buy a $7,000 ring. So while a lot of investors would and you know people we spoke to would say, oh, everything in e-commerce is taken care of, we've seen the e-commerce of diamond jewelry and other luxury lag behind. So the trend to get into it was the time. That was the time to come in and differentiate yourself.
I see. So if I'm understanding you right, you said, look, you didn't notice this whole customization thing, but you did realize more and more e-commerce is going online. And the part that's the slowest to make it online is luxury. We have an opportunity here and with luxury. And I actually saw your site used to be called Rare Pink. Yep. I saw that you did more than engagement rings at the time. You did earrings for a while on the website too, right? It was more of a luxury diamond site.
Yeah, absolutely. So another lesson that it took us a long time to learn and was the fact that, you know, there's a lot of jewelers that are for everything. But I think that the goal is it's hard enough to become good at one thing, never mind trying to become good at like 100 things. So we just saw that this specific opportunity of focusing on the engagement ring. You see, the thing about the engagement ring is that it's a different, even though it's metal and diamonds, and design and an earring or pendant or wedding band is the same thing from components. The purchasing experience of an engagement ring is different from buying because it's more emotionally charged. It's a higher price point. There's more uncertainty because the diamond is often large. Whilst a pair of earrings for your loved one for Christmas, far less kind of investment in time and learning. And also it's transferable. You can buy earrings or you could take on a trip. But the engagement ring isn't quite like that. For some people, it is. You know, some people prefer to not get engaged. But for the most part, that's like a rite of passage that men go through. So because this experience was so well-defined, the engagement ring one, we knew we could learn a lot about it, test and iterate, and we want to become the best place to buy your engagement ring.
I see. I understand why you'd want to focus there instead of going broad. I also understand what you're saying is, look, we had an intuition that people just want to buy engagement rings online. We didn't learn until we started talking to our customers that what they want is customization. Once we understood customization, then the business really started to take off. And that's a mistake that I mentioned earlier, that
All right.
We think we understand. We think we can intuit. And from experience, we could decide things like what you said. You don't sell earrings and diamond rings. Let's focus on diamond rings and maybe later on expand to earrings. What you can't get to without talking to your customers is the depth of the uniqueness of them, which is like there's a strong segment of them that wants to create their own jewelry. What I thought was interesting about where you took it from there is, dude, this company Zapier is coming up more and more in conversations. You use them, like so many other people who I've talked to basically be your like dev shop. Talk about what Zapier, just for anyone who doesn't understand it, and I imagine most people in my audience do, Zapier takes data from one piece of software and moves it to another and back and forth. And now actually you can move it from one to another to another to another. It just connects all the software that we have online. What did you do with Zapier to help yourself get organized and to sell in the beginning?
You know, it's so funny with Zapier. I was using Zapier even before we started the company, and I was one of the very early users. I had like the best account free of charge.
Me too. I still do.
I gave mine up, and then I came back a year later, and I was like, oh, I can't believe I did that. So, you know, it's not just about connecting services. It's connecting them with certain rules, because you always want to go, wouldn't it be nice if I could, and I'll give you a few examples instead of explaining it further. So the most popular one that we use now, the most popular two that we use now, is basically like one of the best ways to grow is obviously through PR and getting featured in blogs and so on, both from a referral traffic and from a link building point of view. So how do we find inbound opportunities? Inbound is always the best. You know, you don't want to go looking for people trying to sell them your business. You want to find people who are interested in what you're doing already. And obviously, one of the most popular ways to do that now is hashtag journal requests. Journalists and bloggers tweeting what they're looking for, then saying hashtag journal request, and then it comes up. Problem is, every single journalist is using it now. It's thousands of posts like this a day. So I made a little list that I followed a bunch of different journalists that were in our space. And I made a little zap that said, every time one of these people specifically uses the hashtag journal request, I want you to send it to my personal Slack channel, like with a little exploding fireworks and everything, because I need a response to that straight away. And from that, we've been featured in Forbes, Financial Times, Telegraph, about to be featured in Virgin. Hopefully I sent my response earlier today.
Wait, so it's journal request? I'm doing a search for that. I don't see anything especially useful here. I'm seeing
on Twitter.
Is it journal or journalist request?
A journal, like as if it's a journalist, but journal. Maybe like a
nickname. Oh, journal. Got it. Because journal requests got people asking for journals.
No, journal.
Looking for guest bloggers to write about tips, tricks of the blogging world or reviews. DM me for more information. I see. Looking for work with great brands this year, journal request. Okay, so some of it is useful and some of it is completely
not. Most of it is not. So, but the only way to get the useful stuff is to follow the people you know are the ones that are writing for publications that you like. And I don't even know if that's a big thing in the US, actually. Maybe it hasn't gone over the pond yet. But following the ones that you know are not going to talk about some nonsense, and then making a zap that tells you as soon as they – and it's funny how we use the word making a zap. It's like a verb now, you know?
Yeah.
Just zap it. So that was one that we did. And another one that we did that we're really proud of is connecting a bunch of our different tools, including our CRM, our emailing campaign, Google Sheets, and our Gecko board to create a Net Promoter Score automation. So there are companies that sell you the service of gathering your Net Promoter Score. And we were like, I'm sure we can just build this ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we use Zapier to basically connect our CRM, sends a little zap to our email marketing software, which sends the, on a scale of 0 to 10, how likely are you to recommend Taylor and Hart to your customers? Yeah. The minute someone clicks on one of those numbers, it sends into Google Sheet the result. And then we create a little formula that projects it onto the Gecko board. And that's created a culture in the company of people really caring about the customer experience, because that number is live on the screen. So every time a customer gives like not a 9 or a 10, that number goes down a little bit, and everyone goes, why? What happened? Who was that? Who said they're not happy? Which never existed in the company until we introduced this kind of full automation. People feel accountable to numbers on a wall. Nothing can make you feel more comfortable than your metric being shown like that.
Can you use Gecko board for that?
Yeah, really cool company.
So now we know how you got your software, how you started building the early version of your software, and still to this day you're using Zapier. We know where you got your diamonds. We know how you understood what to create for your customers. How did you get customers, though?
Sure. So when I was saying in those days as a student, what I was doing was a lot of affiliate marketing and kind of the $1 million homepage type of stuff that we talked about briefly. And what I learned from that, there's a guy called Ed Dale. I'm not sure how many people know him, but he was a veteran in the kind of early days of online marketing. And he created something called the 30-Day Challenge. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool. It ran for a few years. And the idea was in 30 days, you'd watch his videos every single day. There'd be a community and we'd all chat and kind of be together on this adventure in the forums. And in 30 days, the goal was to make your first $5 online. And he taught us all the kind of old school SEO, PPC, content writing, stuff that right now has been really well documented. But back then, it wasn't, as easy. There was a lot of people selling you stuff online about how to do digital marketing. But he was the first that I remembered, like, it was a really high quality and it was free. And I learned a lot about SEO. And when we first started the business, I started creating content with my team. And we started reaching out with that content to various publications in our industry. And slowly we saw traffic start going up, the organic traffic, because no one's got money to invest into Google AdWords. I mean, we use Google AdWords now, but it's the most expensive sales we're ever going to make. And they're getting more and more expensive every single day. So it was mostly SEO.
SEO. Do you remember what was the name of the guy, by the way?
Ed Dale.
Ed Dale. Okay.
Yeah.
And I think he's still
a little
eddale.co, I think, is his URL.
Yeah, that's him.
And so do you remember some of the early pieces of content that did well for you that brought in traffic from Google?
Yeah, it was, again, there's so many, everything's surprising, right? It's like afterwards, it's not surprising looking back, but always looking ahead. So one of the ones that was really surprising was we started not as a getting traffic idea. We started creating celebrity engagement rings because we're doing custom. It's the really cool thing about what you mentioned earlier is this idea of still being excited about what you do. And the thing about doing custom is that every single day we're having these new interesting inquiries. And just when you think, oh my God, like how weird can it get or how interesting can it get? There's someone who's going to surprise you. And so we said, well, let's showcase what we can do. And some of the things that we can do is recreate celebrities' engagement rings. So Blake Lively got engaged two years ago, I don't remember. But it was early on in the business, and we created like this very, very long form piece of content, which analyzed her ring, showed like the poor man's version, the average Joe's version, and like her ring and how they compared. It was really like we're committed to this content. It's what we now call in the company, and a lot of other people call it 10x content. Mm-hmm. It was the best piece on Blake Lively on the internet. And in a couple of months, that was generating like 30% of our traffic. Okay, it wasn't all converting, but that wasn't the goal, right? The goal was to create some brand awareness and to get some links back to the site. So we started creating other celebrity engagement rings, and they've all worked just as well. So that was a little kind of interesting point. And it comes back to what Google always tells everyone. Create content for people that they really like and don't worry about over-optimizing, And like we live by that now. It's all about 10x content. It's not about thousands of links. It's not about like having tens of thousands of pages with different keywords. Is just about creating great content.
Did you guys even create a video around this? You did.
Yeah, we did.
Where you basically took a photo of the ring from her finger, you recreated it, and you put it in a video where the ring is spinning so people can see it all the way around.
Yeah.
I see.
Because you can't see that on a finger, and there's only limited photos. So, and since then we've sold two dozen Blake Lively inspired engagements.
Really? So then people actually wanted to buy the same one.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a beautiful ring.
You know what? It really is. I didn't know what to expect. I thought it was going to be one of these really gaudy rings with a lot of different things going on it. It's pretty simple. At the time, your company was called Rare Pink. Why is that?
So when we first started, we wanted to have a name that resonated with just something unique. We were doing custom engagement rings. And one of our colleagues actually pitched this to us. She came in, we hired her in New York, and she came in when she came to the London office, and she said, guys, you've got to use the pink diamond as your symbol. And we used to put the pink diamond into every single custom engagement ring on the inside of the band. We used to say it's a little secret only the couple shared.
Oh, really? So you would get a ring and only you and your spouse would know there's another diamond inside. I got it. Okay.
Exactly. And that still lives on with Taylor and Hart. We do it with a ruby now, resembling the heart. So there's still a lot of symbolism around it. But yeah, that's kind of the story about where Rare Pink came from. It was just it was the brand mascot. The problem is with the name is that very soon we started having people thinking that all we did was pink diamonds. So it wasn't quite telling the story. And or you know, there was Blue Nile and then there was Rare Pink, and we started thinking, and we got advice when we were at Techstars that the name didn't quite have the kind of scalable luxury. So we were like, well, what are we all about? Well, we're hand finished in Britain, so we wanted something that would resonate with that. I mentioned briefly about the fact that much more of our customers collaborate. So one of our mentors said, you got to use the ampersand. The ampersand is the symbol of these couples working together, and you connect them. You know, the engagement is a connection of two people. So we started having these kind of random concepts of different ideas for the brand, and finally we wanted two words that resembled what we are all about. And the tailor sounds like tailoring, paying tribute to the Savile Row bespoke suit tailors, but we're doing that in jewelry. And heart is obviously it sounds like heart. It's inspiration, where all the custom comes from.
But it's two different names, and there is no tailor at the company. There is no heart at the company, and it gives people a sense that maybe these two people created this company years ago, so it feels dignified, traditional, long-lasting. Yeah. All right, I got to come back to the rest of the story in a moment. First, I have to tell people about a company called TopTal. TopTal is the company that basically gives you the best developers, the best designers, the best MBA people that you can work with one-on-one or have as part of your team. That's what they do. And the reason they do this is because where do you live, Nikolai? What part of the country are you in?
In London.
Oh, you're in London, right. Okay. Yeah. You mentioned it. I'm in San Francisco. I got a friend named Rich. He wanted to work for one of the big guys, actually wanted opportunities to work with all of the big companies, Apple, Facebook, Google. The guy every day after his job went and studied the languages that he would need to work with them, but also more importantly, what is it like to get a job? He brought people in who went through the Google hiring process and had them tutor him and ask him the questions. He went through the Facebook process. He went through all of this stuff to be prepared because that's the kind of person he is. And then he went and he applied for jobs at all these different companies that we all know of, and the screening process was intense. And he went through it because he just had to win, even though he didn't want a job necessarily at every one of them. He knew the one he wanted to work for. He wanted to work at Google, I think. He's just so competitive. He had to like master all of their recruiting processes and get recruited by each one of them because that's who he is. And he did. He got job offers from all of them after all that work. And then he picked Google. And now every day he has to get on the freaking Google bus and take a drive down for about an hour to an hour and a half each way. And lucky him, he got what he was looking for. The thing is that there are a lot of smart developers like him who really are obsessive about getting things right. Nobody will even know the hard work they put into the code that they do. But they have to because they're that obsessive about getting things right. And they don't, though, want to work in Mountain View the way that my friend Rich does. They don't want to go work in Cupertino or in Palo Alto and all these Silicon Valley addresses and spend an hour on the bus each way. They want a life that is meaningful, and they want a job that challenges them. And the people at TopTal recognize this, and they said, you know what, let's give these Googlers and Facebookers and all these other people and Apple – I don't know. I don't think there's a name for Apple engineers. Is there? What are they called? Like apples? Let's give all these kinds of brilliant people a home. We are going to put them in our database of smart developers, and if somebody needs to hire a smart developer, they could come to TopTal, ask for the kind of work that they're looking for, tell them what their company culture is like, tell them if it's a short project, long-term project, if they need a team of people or just an individual, and TopTal will, boom, match them up. That's what it's like at TopTal. I've worked with them. I love them. They've done wonders for my site, and I urge anyone out there who's looking for this level of developers, you will see the good developers, everyone says, are 10 times better than the bad ones. It's more than that. They can outthink the bad ones to a level that they're not even on the same chart. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Absolutely.
And that's the idea behind TopTal. If you want to go check them out, I urge you to not just go to their homepage, but go check out toptal.com/mixergy. Top is in top of the mountain, tal is in talent. When you go to toptal.com/mixergy, they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. People in my audience love them, have gotten great results from them, and I urge you to go check out TopTal. In fact, if you want an intro, just email me and I will make an introduction to TopTal. It's andrew@mixergy.com. I'm telling you, you're going to get good results. And if you're not, you let me know and we'll work it out. But people praise them so much that I'm so happy that we get to talk about them a lot more in 2017. All right, toptal.com/mixergy. Frankly, Nikolai, you might want to write them down. They're going to blow your mind with what they could do when you're ready for them.
Cool.
All right, you're starting to get all these customers in. You ever raise any money, or are you still bootstrapping the whole thing?
So we raised a bit of money. I know in the US it's been quite popular recently and quite topical, crowdfunding. But actually in the UK, because the regulation was relaxed far sooner than it was in the US, it's been quite a popular way of raising investment for a few years. I'm not talking about Kickstarter, which is basically selling products. I'm talking about like pure equity investment. So we used a platform called Cedars, which is like one of our amazing partners that we work with. We raised investment from about 200 different investors, and our first $250,000 came through that. So I'd say that was a bit of friends and family with a little bit of seed money, but the platform allowed our friends and family to invest in a structured way, without us going around and collecting, you know, bits and bobs from everyone. Mm-hmm. So that was where we just kind of started. It was just getting some of the people that knew us in the network and a few new investors to back the idea. We already had a bit of revenue at the time, but not a lot, but more than what a large number of other companies have at that stage. And then following that, at the end of 2015, we raised our seed round. We raised $500,000 from couple of angel investors, one VC out here in Europe, and that's when we really started to kind of test some assumptions faster, increase our marketing budget. And that's when the business started changing, and that's when we realized as well that it might be time to rebrand if we're going to scale this up.
Let's talk about Cedars for a bit and then go into how you got the other angel investors and then what you did with the money. Cedars is Seedrs, right?
Drs, that's right, yeah.
Seedrs, right? What did you learn about getting people to invest through Cedars, about recruiting them?
So I talk on this regularly, actually, because it's such an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. Like for us, crowdfunding is a little bit like something that like I think we could do it for many different companies over and over again. You know, when people become like so good at something, I'm not saying that we're experts then, we're not the 10,000 hours, but there's a lot of things that once you learn them the first time, you can replicate them. And then you can have repeated success. And those things, for example, are, and Tim Ferriss talks about this in a blog post really well. I learned a lot of things from him. Some of those things are preparing in advance. So, for example, the quality of your video, no money should be spared on that. That's a really big part. The most important thing really was having about 30% of the investment committed before launching is critical. In fact, there was a metric that Cedars had. I believe they no longer have this metric. But at the time, they had it and it was like their big metric that they told everyone. They said, if you come to our platform with 30% already committed, we have a 0% failure in the positive form, 100% success rate. So they almost said to you, we guarantee you'll raise money if you come with 30%. I think it wasn't even 30. I think it was like 28 or 27. So it sounded quite low. It sounded, we want to raise $250,000 for our kind of first round. All we need to come in was with like 65 or something. And I think that was really encouraging. So that was an important lesson. The other thing that I learned was it's hard enough raising money from a few angels and a few VCs, but having 200 people talking to you and asking questions, there was a period of time where it was a full-time job. So for any small company founders trying to raise money and thinking that they can just continue with the same momentum, it's not quite the case. I think in most cases, the CEO needs to acknowledge that for a period of time, his role in the company will change. His or her role in the company will change.
What did you have to do when you were on Cedars?
So it's quite simple to get on there. You've got your pitch, you've got your value proposition, your financial metrics, a video. But then what happens is that you have to start outreaching to people that have invested in similar consumer retail brands, outreaching to bloggers who talk about investment opportunities. So there's a large number of bloggers. So there's this whole kind of marketing campaign that's not even marketing for your core business. The good thing is that you don't expect is how much comes back from all of that. So your investors become customers. Your investors become brand ambassadors. You know, who was it that said that if you get to 1,000 true brand ambassadors, you know, that's the first goal you need to have. So if you're crowdfunding and you have 500 investors, you know, these people are passionate about it. And it wasn't until we had an investor event and I asked someone why they invested £10, you know, I said, what was your motivation? And she said to me, it's really cool to tell people that I'm an investor in a diamond business.
Ah.
So the motivation behind that spectrum of investing from $10 or pounds all the way up to 50,000 is quite different. And you have to understand that some people are investing not expecting a return, but have different motivations. And people at a higher level have obviously very much investment motivations.
Were they sending you customers too?
Absolutely. We created like a little special discount just for investors and incentivize them in that way, you know, to say thank you. And yeah, they continue to come back.
How'd you find your more traditional angel investors?
The best way is through your network. And it took me a while to figure out some of the hacks, as you can maybe say, for investment. Mm-hmm. So for example, I didn't realize that my lawyer could introduce me to VCs because... You know, that's an obvious one, but again, not obvious at first.
Why could your lawyer introduce you to VCs?
Well, he's our lawyer that helped us to close our round, so he's doing a lot of rounds with funds and, investors. And so that's why it obviously made sense. AngelList was a godsend. We used it a lot to find similar investors. And then I'd use Conspire to see if someone I knew that person, which is also a great tool.
How does Conspire work?
So as far as I know, Conspire connects your LinkedIn, your AngelList, and your Gmail account, mm-hmm. if you obviously use Gmail. And through those three systems, it understands the strength of the connections between different people.
Yeah.
And it knows, for example, if I want to speak with you, and there's someone in the middle, that you're really good friends with them, and I'm really good friends with them, so it will tell me that that's the best person to reach out to if I want to chat with you.
I see that you were you also in... Techstars?
Yeah.
When did you get into Techstars?
We did that last year. We were the 2016 cohort in Boston.
So you came into Boston. This was after you started getting customers though, right? After you figured out your market, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So Techstars Boston is an interesting accelerator because at the time they had a track record of attracting slightly more mature companies. So all the companies in our cohort had traction. In fact, a couple of them were even, you know, far ahead of us in terms of traction. So the structure of the accelerator wasn't so much about validating core ideas. It was about validating some assumptions that were holding you back from being able to scale.
Like what? What are some for you?
So I mentioned earlier that one of them was about understanding the customer better. And it was about this idea of who is the customer, the persona. And we were saying it was a guy who was going to propose as a surprise. And then the minute we realized that women were that involved, our entire thinking about our marketing strategy stopped being so guy-focused, and it became two different angles. So we have these women personas, and we have these guy personas, and we need to treat them differently. Yes, okay, so some of these ladies didn't go on to put their credit card in the checkout page, but can we create systems that tell us how they kind of connected? So we started using in our CRM, we started having not just a single customer, but we have a customer and we have their partner. And we connect them as best we can. You know,
what's your CRM? You guys are using Insightly?
No, we use Salesforce.
Salesforce, okay.
Salesforce is a bit, I think, for larger companies, but we're not going back. We're really happy with the reporting that it provides. But we don't use any of the advanced Salesforce features, to be honest, because they're too expensive. So what we've done is we've Zapiered everything into Salesforce. So we use Salesforce for its core reporting and CRM functionality, but then everything else is startups that do things better than I think they do.
Wow, wow. I love that you're doing that. And you know what? I could see why it's important to talk to your customers, because your data would have completely misled you. Would have thought that women are just kind of browsing and yeah. wasting your time, when in reality, what they're doing is teeing up a customer for you, and they need yeah. to be treated out. How do you know if it's a woman who's coming to your site versus me?
So here's the interesting thing about our business that happened also during Techstars. There was a few things that happened. So one of the things that we learned as well is we gained the confidence. And that's the main thing about, I think, the accelerator, is that once you're in a place where you've tested some assumptions, but you're moving slower than you'd like, it gives you the confidence to make some decisions quickly. And one of those decisions was dropping the e-commerce business model. Like, that was like a major one. So what I mean by that, on the old platform, just before we rebranded, you could go and you could choose a ring, add a diamond, and check out, and you could buy it. And that's the way that we thought we'd scale. Touchless, beautiful, you know, people, customers do all the work. The reality was that when we dug into the data in Boston, we found that only 5% of our customers actually did this.
Meaning they came to the site, clicked, blah, 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 and bought.
Without us knowing who they were.
And then what did the other 95% do?
The other 95% would come onto the site, have several visits, and at some point make an inquiry. And at that point, they become a lead in our CRM, and then they go through a sales process of education. Now, the problem is, because some of them came so late, they'd already received so much guidance and education that wouldn't necessarily be what we'd recommend, and we didn't think it was. We thought some of it was ill-advised as well. And the jewelry industry is a bit notorious about these things. You know, you have jewelers hating on other jewelers, like things that we would never do, but it has that kind of side to it where not everybody's giving the same advice, you know, whether it's on certification of the diamond or the sourcing of the gemstones or whatever. And for us, it became really important to capture the customer early so we could take them through a process, educate them. And we decided to do that. We're going to drop the e-commerce part. And we're going to become lead gen, and we're going to develop a killer sales process. We're going to use the best systems for managing that process. And suddenly, we are a tech-enabled consumer brand, but really, all that technology is helping us have an efficient and effective sales process, but we're not touchless anymore. And what we found, and this was the thing that we needed to find, because otherwise this whole assumption would fall flat, is that in the unit economics of our business, by adding the cost of service, we still increase the conversion rate so much that the gross profit that we get at the end would still be better than we got when we didn't have service. So if that makes sense.
Yeah. And that explains why, where I click on your site on design a custom ring, there's a button that says start now. And when I click it, I don't get to start now. They say, we're going to have a personal consultant contact you. That explains why some people might have even heard every time I go to your website, there's like a little chiclet sound. That's an intercom that you guys use that tries to encourage me, or does encourage me, to get in a conversation with someone from Taylor & Hart. That kind of thing, I get it now. And so that's your process. It's not come on the site and start buying. It's come on the site and start talking to someone, which frankly, again, going back to my own experience with this, I wanted to talk so much. I kept going back into the store. I wanted to understand.
Right. And that's where it came from, lessons like that as well. You know, we had these people who would have 100 emails backwards and forwards. We try and automate a lot of it, right? So one automation we have now is that we have this kind of guidance and inspiration automation, which has got no sales linked to it at all. But it's the 7 things that we've realized customers most care about. And we need your email to be able to educate you on that. Otherwise, you have to find it on our site. And we can try and show you and give you a lot of cues to where it is. But really, that's one thing that's been really useful to us, because by the time customers come, they already have a good idea of what's going on in the process and so on.
The thing that I mentioned earlier that I really love about your process is that you also will say, look, if there's a guy like Andrew who wants to propose but is not sure which one he wants and how to design it, what you'll do is you'll send me a proposal ring that I get to use to propose, and then I get the actual ring. Am I right?
Yeah. I'm not sure if someone else has already coined this term or uses it. It doesn't feel like the kind of thing that we came up with, but we hadn't heard of it when we did. And it came from this kind of hesitancy of that other 25% that isn't designing, that is designing on their own as a complete surprise. It's this kind of trade-off. You don't want to trade off the surprise for the confidence that the ring is the right ring. If in the best case scenario, you'd have both. And then we did like a session with like a UX session with a couple of people from the Techstars cohort who were in the market, and we discovered that the surprise was an important part. They wanted to have that kind of photo, you know, beautiful surprise where she has no idea the family and friends are there. By the way, Americans do proposals very differently from in the UK and in Europe. You guys are like, fireworks, everybody needs to know. Yeah, it's a little bit more conservative. So it was really good to be there to learn the different cultural aspects. So, they want that surprise, but at the same time, they want to have the right ring.
Right.
Because we heard these horror stories of people like hating their ring for years and not wearing it, or not being confident to say anything because the guy spent so much money and so on and so on and so on. So the idea to create what we call the proposal ring is like the best case scenario, in my opinion. Like I try and sell this to every customer, and some guys will be like, no, that's not me. And some guys are like, oh my God, thank God you told me about this. So the idea is you design the ring. You do what you think she'd like, you know, like you go get those brownie points for doing the work of designing the ring. And what we're going to do after that is, if it's a complicated design, we're just going to print it out on a really nice card with the designer signing it off for you. But if it's not too complicated, we're actually going to make it for you, and we're going to make it in silver. And we're going to set it with the real diamond, the diamond that you've bought. Now, the thing that I tell the guys here that like hopefully gets them over the hurdle is, and the good thing here is that you've also locked in the price, because most of the cost is the diamond, and you've already bought that. So later on, when you come in for your consultation, it's not going to be a question of, oh, but I bought a, you know, an $8,000 diamond, and now you're looking at a $16,000 one, because you're going to say, we're going to design a beautiful ring for you, and it's going to be around this diamond that you've already bought. So the idea is, you propose with the proposal ring, and then you tell your loved one that this is the design, this is what you've done. Do you love it? If you do, let's go in for a consultation. We're going to also check her ring size. Another big benefit to this, because most guys have no idea, and they try and do things, cheeky things like checking it with a string while she sleeps, which we always say don't do. She's going to catch you.
Or taking in another ring and bringing it in, which actually does not work because they don't all fit right.
They don't fit right. If she's not wearing it on that hand, on that finger, even if she wears it on the other hand, most people don't know that, you know, we're not symmetrical. So our right hand is about half to one size bigger than our left hand per finger.
I had a problem where I got it from Tiffany because I knew that they were I just knew the brand. But in reality, if I knew this existed, I would have done this. The nice thing about them was, I said, if there's a problem, I could just take it in and they could fix it. And so they resized the ring after I bought it, because I definitely got the size wrong, and they did stuff like that. I just had no idea this thing existed. And I'm thinking, maybe I need to divorce my wife and go marry someone else just so I could try this.
Or you can just, you know, do a consultation.
You know how much she I once made a joke about that in an interview. You know how much she like was really hurt by that?
Okay.
I should not say that.
It is.
All right. But yeah. I dig what you guys are doing. I really admire how much you've grown and the process behind it. I like hearing your methodology. Why don't we close out with one last thing, since I promised it to the audience? I said that we talk about what you did with marketing after you raised money. Can you give me one thing that you did that helped grow the business after you raised money?
Yeah, sure. So probably the most interesting thing that we've done, and it was really important, is it's definitely the hardest thing I've ever done in marketing, because if you are not a digital product, a service, or, you know, a SaaS business or something like that, then your gross profit analysis per person is very easy to calculate. But we are a manufacturing product business. We're not even a drop shipping business with the same SKUs. So we've got the situation where we're spending a lot of money on customer acquisition, on Google AdWords and affiliates and other channels, and then we're making a sale, and then we're not knowing what's working and what's not. I mean, we know in aggregate it's working, but how do you scale up a marketing channel from $5,000 a month to $100,000 without having the confidence that that's working? So return on ad spend is a metric that has been very aspirational for us. We've wanted it, but we've never been able to have it, because it required two things. And the first thing is, on the marketing side, I don't want to get too technical, so interrupt me if I do, but on the marketing side, attribution is a pain in the ass for us. Why? Most companies that sell something e-commerce, you've got a guy coming, maybe comes back two or three times within a 30-day period, and then you'll buy, and it's easy. You know that the first click was Mixergy because you mentioned the product. Boom, you know, sale was done. For us, we've got people who are designing a ring for a year sometimes.
Right.
And they're coming to the website 40 different channels on their phone. By the way, 65% of our users are on their phone, but they're not buying on their phone. They're buying on the desktop in the end. So again, attribution is a challenge. So fixing the attribution or figuring out where inquiries are coming from was a pain in the ass. And what fixed it was finally getting some good systems in, like HubSpot. HubSpot's a really good system for attribution.
Okay.
So if anyone's having that problem, then I highly recommend it. And also making the inquiry happen very early, because then what happens is, on the second or the third visit, we've got that email, it connects. Now we have a user as opposed to a random visitor. And then on the supply side, figuring out how to connect the individual gross profit per product to that, so that we can at the end say, from this channel, we made this amount of profit as opposed to sales. And this is like a complicated business problem that we've had to solve, and we were just too small to figure it out. And we're finally there. And it's really helped with our business, because we've just gone, wow, look at that affiliate partner. We did that last year in December. We were like, what is going on? That's like 10% of our revenue. Who knew? Get on the phone with them and say, what would it take for us to rank number one for when you search jewelry, this, this, and this. And then they told us, they were like, yeah, increase your discount. And we're like, yeah, increase it. Like, what do you want? And yeah, and it's become like a really cool, and we would never have known because, you know, we just see affiliates. It's great. Some, we've got 15 affiliates. Who's doing that? We don't know, but affiliates working, keep going. So I think being able to identify individual wins and linking them to profitability and then scaling them up as much as possible is probably one of the hardest things for growth. And being able to figure that out was a massive benefit.
I can understand that. Yeah. And you know what? And even as you said it, I can see how tough it is to maintain it, but there are aspects of it that we can all learn from. Like the easiest thing is get that email address fast, so at least you know where that person came from. And then if they're messing around on your site for the next year, it doesn't matter if you haven't recorded it, as long as you know at the end who that person is, you can tie it back to the source. All right. For anyone who wants to check out the website, it's taylorandhart.com. You guys also own the .co from what I saw, right?
I don't think so, but we have all the misspellings so of Taylor and Hart. So you should be able to find it no matter what you do. But it's A-Y and Hart is without the E. It's the British names, not the
Don't. The reason I thought that .co was, I was looking to see where your referrals were, and it looked like that was sending you traffic. But no, that's not up. All right, taylorandhart.com. It's a really interesting site from a marketing point of view to take a look at. And I'm really grateful to you for coming here and talking about how you built the business. And the two sponsors that you guys heard me talk about, the first is the one that's designing a really great cover art for me for iTunes and other platforms. It's called Design Crowd. Get a huge discount from them. Go to designcrowd.com/mixergy. And I like how they use my photo there. And the second is a company that will help you hire a great developer. Really see what a great developer can do for your business. Try them out at toptal.com/mixergy. I'm grateful to them for sponsoring. Thank you so much for being here.
Andrew, thank you.
Cool. Bye, everyone.